Well, hello, everyone. My name is Dr. Sherry Tenpenny, and I want to extend a warm welcome to everyone who's joining us here this week on This Week with Dr. T. Each week, we get together every Monday morning. We have amazing guests that have conversations that are interesting and inspiring. If you've missed some of those great discussions in the past, you can go to drtenpenny.com, hover over the podcast tab, and sign into your premium podcast area. If you're not a premium podcast member, you will find that we've created four different levels of membership, something to fit everyone's time and budget. But before I introduce to you today's special guest that I've been so looking forward to this conversation, we're going to take a really quick break. Sit tight. You won't want to miss this. We'll be right back. Zeolite is a detox spray. We work specifically with a company called Touchstone Essentials. They are an incredible company. We've been working with them now for several years. And zeolite is a mineral that goes through your body like a one-way basket. It will clean out heavy metals such as arsenic and mercury, aluminum, cadmium, and it hooks onto those metals from a one-way perspective. So once it's bound, it goes out through your urine or your stools and doesn't get redeposited in other places. Everybody needs to have a detox product in their life, and this one is so easy to use, and it's so safe. You can take it when you're pregnant, you can take it when you're nursing, you can give it to little children, you can even give it to infants, and quite frankly, I give it to my dog. I actually put a little bit of the zeolite in his water, because until we all stop living in a toxic world, we all need to get some of those extra toxicities out. The heavy metals, the persistent organic pollutants, the things that are floating through the air, the different things that we come in touch within our environment. And we are a big fan of zeolite from Touchstone Essentials. We've been a big, big, big fan of their products for several years.
Go to drtenpenny.com/detox to get your first bottle of zeolite spray for $50 off.
Well, welcome back, everyone. I'm so glad that you're here this morning. Let me introduce to you today's special guest, Dr. Merle Nass. Dr. Merle Nass has been an internal medicine physician since 1980. She was the first to prove in 1992 that the epidemic of anthrax in Rhodesia was biological warfare. She gave six congressional testimonies between 1999 and 2009 regarding anthrax, Gulf War syndrome, and vaccine safety. In addition, between 1993 and 2008, she consulted with the Cuban Ministry of Health, the World Bank, and the Director of National Intelligence on Chemical and Biological Warfare. During that same period, she helped countless military service members and their families fight against the anthrax vaccine mandates. During the COVID debacle, Merle wrote endless and detailed articles regarding the suppression of HCQ and ivermectin as a early treatment for COVID-19 and the cover-up of the COVID-19 origin. As we have moved forward, she's taken on even a larger and more onerous task, the World Health Organization's proposed pandemic treaty and its amendments, which have its goal to wrest sovereignty from individual nations and under the guise of pandemic preparedness. As an advisor to Children's Health Defense, her focus has been on the World Health Organization biosecurity agenda for the last couple of years. She's traveled around the world, beating the drum of awareness and waking people up to what is coming. Merle, thanks you so much for being here this week. It's been far too long and far overdue that I should have had you on my show a long time ago, but we're both pretty busy and I'm so grateful that you could squeeze me in your schedule for right now.
Yeah, Sherry, it's good to see you, and it's good to see you back to your old self. And so I'm very grateful that you have to tell me the things that you did that got you back there so quickly and so well.
Well, we will do that on another conversation. But today we're going to be talking about you, not about me. And I want to talk first importantly, because I've always known you. I mean, all the years that I've known you, it's been at least 20 years that, you know, we've kind of run in the same circles, but not necessarily run into each other. And I've known your about your vaccine activism, and I've always thought about you as the anthrax expert. And reading your bio, I didn't know about this whole thing of identifying how anthrax was the first bio warfare. What got you interested in anthrax and even went going down that rabbit hole?
Yeah. Well, I was in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Okay.
So I was a young doctor in my 30s. I was recently divorced and I had two small kids, and I went to a Physicians for Social Responsibility meeting. And I was living in Amherst, Massachusetts, and that's where the University of Massachusetts main campus is located. And they apparently, four professors had moved from Fort Detrick to the University of Massachusetts when the government ended its offensive biological warfare program, which was in the early 70s. So I was there in the late 80s. But so UMass had professors who had been biological warfare. What can you say? You know, they worked for they worked on offensive and defensive biological warfare at Fort Detrick. And students found out that one of them was still had contracts with the Defense Department to develop a better anthrax vaccine. And they thought this is probably germ warfare, and they protested it. And they asked our organization to help them figure out what exactly he was doing. And I said, well, I don't think studies into a better anthrax vaccine are germ warfare. That didn't sound right to me. So the men in the meeting said, well, then why don't you read the contract and read the guy's curriculum vitae and report back to us at the next meeting? So I said, okay. And I did, and I found out that even though the contract was titled Studies for a Better Anthrax Vaccine, it actually, there was no vaccine research in it at all. It was all about moving the plasmids around in anthrax and other bacillus species. I realized it was sort of a primitive form of genetic engineering. And why would you be doing that for a disease that only affects one person in the United States every decade, right?
Oh, wow.
Why would you be doing that? So I thought, wow, this is something that needs to be explored some more. And so did the American Friends Service Committee. So they had an office in the next town, and they decided to get involved with this. And so I did too, and I worked with them, and we got lots and lots of information about the Defense Department program that this fellow was working for. And I wound up spending years researching it and writing some papers about how the United States government was not following its own mission statement, the law, et cetera. It was going beyond what it was supposed to be doing for defensive research. And I also decided in the midst of that to look into all the recent anthrax epidemics to see, well, why are they so worried about anthrax as a biological weapon? There really isn't much anthrax around, but maybe it has been used as a biological weapon. So I got my hospital librarian to order me all the articles from the last 15 years on anthrax epidemics, which were a little hard to get. Some of them were only collected by one library in the entire country.
Wow.
And I read all of them, and I realized that one of them was completely different from all the others, and it probably had been biological warfare. And then I felt obliged to pursue it and see if I could prove it or prove it wasn't. And I spent the next 3 years doing that and was able to prove that it was, in fact, biological warfare, and that there were ways that you could identify a deliberate biological warfare attack from a natural epidemic, at least for some diseases. And so I published that also. So I wound up, you know, getting a lot of juice out of the I was doing. And that sort of made me well known within that community. And the Gulf War happened at the same time. So then I sort of became a spokesperson on biological warfare and anthrax, because suddenly anthrax became, you know, 2 years after I had gotten involved, anthrax became a big deal during the Gulf War and lead up to it. And then later, I was asked to get involved with Gulf War syndrome and study that and write about it and testify before Congress about that as well. I basically read everything that was published about anthrax in those years. So I drove around from one medical library to another and drove to the Harvard library basement where old Boston medical journals were crumbling in my fingers from the 1830s,
Oh, wow.
And read about individual anthrax cases that had been reported then. So when I got done, I sort of had this extremely broad understanding. And I was also reading about the studies that were being done at Fort Detrick. So what they were doing on anthrax. So anyway, I had a really, really broad understanding of the science and the history. And when the anthrax letters came, I wound up knowing more than almost anybody in the country about what was going on and what do you do and what does it mean? And, you know, all of that. So then again, you know, I wound up testifying before Congress on that and being a consultant to the World Bank about how to protect, you know, how do you protect institutions like the World Bank, et cetera. And anyway, it was just really, it was serendipity. I had never expected any of this to happen. I was just a young doctor trying to raise my kids. And it turned out that the information that I had filled up my head with became important. You know,
it's interesting how God gives us tasks to do sometimes, and we just follow the little rabbit trail, and you're just doing your thing just because you're a physician and you're inquisitive and you figure there's something to this. And then suddenly it blossoms into something incredibly useful and different. And it was what the intent was all along. How did you end up being a consultant in Cuba? Because that would have been during a time where, you know, America and Cuba still were pointing guns at each other.
Right. So I looked all over for information about this Rhodesian anthrax biological warfare event. And one of the places I looked was a magazine called Covert Action, because they had run a lot of articles about covert military events in Africa. And I thought they might know something. And so they didn't, although they did run a sort of a version of the story that I uncovered. But then the publisher of Covert Action, I guess, had a Cuba connection. And so Cuba started, so some about, I don't know, 6 months or a year after I'd published my article on Rhodesia's anthrax as biological warfare, I was asked to look into this blindness epidemic that was ongoing in Cuba. And I said, there are no blindness epidemics, at least not in this part of the world. And so I was given information about it. And I started, you know, I thought, well, this is sort of up my alley. So I started looking into it and discovered that it was actually due to cyanide and combination with nutritional deficiencies that made it difficult to detoxify cyanide. So you could get cyanide in food, in cigarette or cigar smoke, things like that. And people in, so it, I actually made a very interesting discovery, although I never wrote it up, which is that there were four medical conditions and they all had the same pathophysiology essentially, but they had different names. So one of those was a disease in Nigeria, in which people during a famine, people were eating a lot of cassava, and cassava has cyanide in it. And you wash the cassava to get rid of the cyanide, but you don't get rid of all of it. And so when the Nigerians didn't have anything to detox the cyanide with in terms of other nutrients, they would come down with this optic and peripheral neuropathy, which could cause blindness. And so that had a name. I can't think of it offhand. And then there's a hereditary disease called Leber's optic and peripheral neuropathy, in which people who have one of several different mutations, which could be mitochondrial mutations or in the rest of the genome, wind up also being susceptible to cyanide and lack of B12. B12, not cyanocobalamin, which has the cyanide moiety already attached, but methylcobalamin or hydroxycobalamin will be used as a way to bind cyano or cyanide moieties. Small, you know, cyanide is a molecule, hydroxy, what is it? HCN, right? Nitrogen, carbon, and hydrogen. That's cyanide, just those three atoms. And So that will bind to a B12 cobalamin residue and detoxify it. And so that's one of the major ways that we get rid of cyanide in our diet or in cigarette or cigar smoke. And anyway, the Cubans had been basically put on had a famine. We're suffering from a famine because the United States had imposed the Helms-Burton Act, which stopped nations. It was a very tight embargo, stopped other nations from trading with Cuba and stopped boats that docked in Cuba would not be allowed to dock in the United States. So they were getting a lot of food from overseas, and suddenly the boats couldn't dock there anymore. So they had a limited amount of vitamins as a result. When this went on for a year or more, it's gone on for many years subsequently. And most of them were not taking vitamins. Hadn't needed vitamins up until then. And probably some cyanide was put into foodstuffs or water or some way, not enough to kill them, but enough to cause serious neuropathies that responded to B12 and responded to other nutrients.
Wow.
So anyway, there was that. So there was the Cuban disease, and then the Liebers would cause the same thing because people weren't able to, I guess, detoxify cyanide. And so people with these certain genetic conditions were at high risk of developing optic and other neuropathies. And then the final one is something that was called alcohol, tobacco, amblyopia. And it was the same thing. Alcoholics who weren't eating much food and therefore didn't have the nutrients to detox cyanide and were smoking were getting the cyanide in, unable to detoxify it, and would wind up also with a sudden blindness. And anyway, the treatment for all of them is vitamins and nutrients. And it was fun discovering that.
Yes, very much so. You know, the other thing that you were involved with the anthrax issue, was the Gulf War syndrome, you know, and you did a lot to help people to get exemptions to not get the anthrax vaccine. Number one, two questions of that. One is, are we still seeing it? And did anything come of all of the stuff that we did, you, me, and other people, to push back against the anthrax vaccine? And number two, are they still using the anthrax vaccine in the military?
So in the military, it was almost impossible to get an exemption of any kind. It was sort of like the COVID vaccines, where it was a biological loyalty oath, and they would throw you out of the military rather than let you have an exemption. Now looking back, I think it was a kind of dress rehearsal for COVID. Is wow. How can we clamp down and get away with it? In some cases, people were held down in the military and forcibly injected. In other cases, they would be sent. Well, you said you had a reaction. Well, we're going to send you to the immunologist, and they're going to maybe do a skin test. And if you don't react to the skin test, they'll jab you with another dose of the vaccine, like right there in the immunologist would, while you're having your skin test done. It was wild. But one reason the anthrax vaccine was so bad at that time, it's not a good vaccine. It's not filtered. It's full of all sorts of unidentified.
They relabeled the expiration dates. They did all kinds of horrible
stuff. Right, exactly. Like that. So most of the stockpile at the beginning was multiply expired, 2, 3, 4 times expired, redated. And 9 out of 11 million doses were immediately quarantined by FDA because they could see visible particulates either from the stoppers or from bacteria or fungi growing in the vials.
Oh, my goodness.
But unfortunately, the FDA wound up allowing the military to use 2 million of its 11 million dose stockpile. And those 2 million made a huge, you know, many thousands of people sick. Then they bulldozed the factory. They completely rebuilt it. Things were cleaner. The vaccines weren't expired. And so now occasionally people still get these illnesses from it, but not so many are receiving the vaccine. And it's not quite as bad as it was before. Still, I wouldn't recommend it. It's never been shown to actually work. in a biological warfare setting. So why would you use it? We don't know if it works for inhalation.
And for them to have to get six of those injections in a series. And I saw quite a few patients during that time in my practice, because we have a couple of local military bases up here that were horribly vaccine injured from those shots. And they were, fit, healthy, active men. And they were, they kind of turned them into almost like a stiff man syndrome, that they just couldn't move. And everything that they tried to move was extraordinarily painful. And it's just an awful sort of thing that they have continued to use our military as a pincushion for all kinds of things, including the COVID jabs. So I think that's really important.
Actually, if you start, you of all people probably know this better than I. If you read vaccine literature, you see that often it's the military that they test vaccines in around the world.
Yep. And it started with the smallpox vaccine. There was actually several papers that were written in the 1800s from military like commanders begging the government to not do this to their soldiers. And they were, you can find them on archive.org, the Wayback When Machine. You can find those documents there, and they're heart-wrenching and angry. And it's kind of like, everything that we're doing now, we're just history repeating itself, stuff of what happened back in the 1800s. Well, with that, Merle, we're going to take a really quick break. We're talking today with Dr. Merle Nass. When we come back, we're going to talk about the World Health Organization treaty, which she has really dug into, and you won't want to miss this. Sit tight. We'll be right back.
Gold and silver always has value. It never goes to zero. And it's a great place to store your wealth. It's a great place to have it for inheritance, for your children, for your grandchildren. And when you can actually get the coins itself, when you can actually do that, you can actually even have a coin collection. I think that some of the older Walking Liberty silver dollars are just amazing, that come from the early 1900s. And I think that everybody should have some of those, not only for history, but as a place to protect your wealth, protect your money going forward. It never goes to zero. Like our paper fiat money with hyperinflation and the things that we may be seeing in the future, our dollar could literally go to zero. It could be worth nothing. You might not even be able to barter with it, but you will always have value in gold and silver. You'll always be able to eat with it. You'll be able to trade with it. And it's a great place to store your wealth. Particular company that we work with, because we really, again, trust their product. We believe that this company has a high level of integrity, and they are great with customer service. To learn more, go to bit.ly/gold-silver-DRT. That's bit.ly/gold-silver-DRT. We also have an apparel line on our store that has just the best things. In fact, I go and shop at my own store. I mean, I really do go and buy stuff out of my own store. They have t-shirts and sweatshirts and cups and mugs and totes. We've got a great designer. We're always adding new things all the time. And either one of those two product lines, either our private label supplements, our Opti line, the white bottles with the green leaves on it, or with the apparel store, and they're two separate stores. They do not have a single shopping cart. It's like you go in one store and get your groceries, and you go to the other store and get your shoes. Well, these are two separate stores, but you can use the same affiliate code. If you use the code podcast, when you go to the checkout, you can get 10% off on everything you buy every time you go to the store.
Well, welcome back, everyone. Thank you so much. And before the break, we were talking about anthrax and anthrax disease and all kinds of things that Merle has been an expert in that arena her whole life. And like she said, kind of like put her stake in the stand about talking about anthrax and vaccine issues. And then that was an easy rollover into COVID issues. How did you get from that into digging through this incredibly boring, complex, double-speak document of the World Health Organization treaty that's coming up for vote in May?
Well, let's see. I was working with Children's Health Defense Europe, and people there were more aware that something's going on at the WHO. And I knew about One Health already, because I just knew about it. You know, people in the biodefense field had been involved with One Health, and I thought it was just a joke. You know, I thought it was some ridiculous thing that they'd come up with that wasn't going anywhere. And I didn't realize it was a means to sort of lasso the whole world and put it under the rubric of health. But anyway, it was suggested that I was going to a conference in May in Sweden anyway to give a talk 2 years ago. And right after that, there was going to be this meeting in Geneva of the World Health Organization, and they were bringing forward some amendments to change the international health regulations. And the United States had suggested this. So I was planning to go to Geneva, but in fact, on the way, in Sweden, I broke my hip. I fell. So
oh, wow.
I had to cancel that trip, but excuse me, it gave me... Anyway, I was looking into the documents, and what I found was, you know, there are treaties. So the World Health Organization, unlike all other agencies under the UN, has its own constitution and can make treaties with nations. Unlike the UN, it does not have a Security Council that has veto power, so that the WHO is kind of a law unto itself. There is no higher authority. Pardon me. And when the WHO was set up and its constitution was written, it was not put under the jurisdiction of any court. So you can't take the WHO to court. There is no court that can listen to cases with the WHO. And everybody who works there and all the diplomats who come have a form of diplomatic immunity. So you can't go after them individually either if they claim they're just whatever it is they're doing that you think is terrible is in the course of their employment or their occupation. And so the WHO has this incredible ability to avoid being accountable like no other organization. And so I think it was chosen by globalists as an ideal place. And plus it was for health, right? Health is a good thing. We all have to rah-rah for health and help the third world, help the developing nations. That's, you know, that's what we have to do. And I'm very much in favor of helping developing nations, but that is not really the primary thing that WHO is about. So the WHO was chosen, and it had a set of regulations called the International Health Regulations that had been developed in 1969 and modified it a few times since then, but they were primarily about dealing with maritime infections in staff on ships and cargo on ships. So a lot of times ships carry actually animals. And so if the animals got sick or the people got sick in transit between one country and another, well, what do you do? Who has authority? What decisions need to be made? You know, who can make them? That's what these international health regulations were about. Well, some smart lawyers realized they could do a lot more with these documents. So since 1969, they were expanding the scope of them. But up until the present time, they've only been regulations, which is advice. They don't really give the WHO the power to compel nations to do things, except under very limited circumstances of a ship docks and the cargo are sick or the sailors are sick. Okay, that gives the WHO some authority to manage that situation, but that's it. People, lawyers got the idea they could take this document and basically give the authority to the WHO to manage the whole world if there's a pandemic. So the United States started this a couple of years ago, put forth a bunch of amendments saying, let's vote on these and see if we can accept them. And the nations, particularly a block of almost 50 African nations said, no, we don't like them. We don't really want to hand off more power to the WHO. And so the United States took back, retrieved those amendments and said, well, let's do something else. So it's everybody think of how you want to amend this document and make suggestions. Why don't all the nations make suggestions about how we should improve the international health regulations? And so 100 nations offered 300 amendments, and then the WHO itself offered seven. So they had 307 potential amendments to the document, and then committees started working on them. And they created by November of 2022 a new document with a variety of amendments blended in. And since then, they've continued to work on it, and we don't know what they've been doing. It's been completely secret, very, very deep secrecy for this document. But the nations of the world and several different committees have been trying to negotiate a whole new set of international health regulations that will be binding on nations, that the whole thing will be binding, not just what do we do with the animals that are sick, but it will. So the version that we have is the version that was presented in November of 2022. That's the last thing we saw. We thought they were going to provide an updated version in January, but the WHO did not. And now we don't know. We think maybe in April, maybe in May, and they're going to vote on this document at the end of May. What we saw in it is that the WHO is creating a pathogen library. So potential pandemic pathogens are what they're called, which is another way of saying potential biological warfare agents, you know, viruses and bacteria that can cause a pandemic. The WHO is building a biohub, laboratories that will collect these agents, study them, and potentially do gain of function research on them. They're also going to share them globally with universities, pharmaceutical companies, and research centers. And they demand that all the nations go out and collect them and then sequence them. So every nation is supposed to now develop genetic sequencing laboratories. Why you would want to do that in every nation is very curious. And I wonder if it's about eventually sequencing all our genomes. But for the time being, they want the viruses that are caught to be sequenced and then placed online, specifically online in a public database, like GISAID, GISAID, which is a public database of viruses, where presumably hackers or scientists can download them and recreate them, even if they don't have a sample. So this is this is opening the door to one pandemic after another. It's opening the door to lab leaks, to deliberate releases. It's just a completely crazy idea. And it goes against the 1972 Biological Weapons Convention and a national security memorandum of the Security Council from 2004. It's just insane. So the WHO pretends that those documents don't exist. They never make reference to them. And they just say, this is what we're going to do. In addition to, there's much more. So they also want to force all nations to put into place by law, using law, an EUA system so that vaccines and drugs can be rolled out to the populations without a license. In other words, without testing, without proper testing.
Or informed consent, or in
exposure
to what's actually inside of the vial or inside of the pill. I mean, that's all part of the EUA thing. You know, Merle, you know, back when I first started learning about covered countermeasures was in 2005 when I wrote the book on bird flu. It was called Bird Flu, It's Not What You Think. And I was writing it in real time with what was happening with the bird flu epidemic. And all of this stuff was coming out about cover countermeasures and how the world would be run by these people. And the Secretary of Health and Human Services, even in the U.S., would be the most important and the most powerful person in our entire country in terms of making determinations on what would be done, who, again, is one more appointed official, not an elected official, so not touchable by the people. And it just seems like this whole treaty thing has just... it started there with Margaret Chan, who was head of the WHO at the time, has just continued to grow into this bigger and bigger and bigger all-encompassing behemoth. You know, you've been traveling around, you know, most of Europe, and you've talked to even, I think, our own Congress people, at least a few of them. Are they getting it? Are they seeing how awful this is going to be if this gets implemented, passed and implemented?
So everyone I speak to is shocked, you know, and I show screenshots from the treaties themselves. There's two. So there's also a pandemic treaty in addition to these amendments. And it's all been made very complicated by the WHO. So almost nobody can understand. And, you know, it took me months to really grasp all of this because it was so detailed and odd the way, you know, I had to hire lawyers to go through the documents and explain some of the things to me. But I've briefed about 17 members of Congress at least, and many parliamentarians in different countries, and about half a dozen countries in Europe, and so they all get it. The thing is that their compatriots who don't come to the briefings don't get it. Mm-hmm. And the WHO just grossly lies about what's in the documents. And U.S. government officials have lied to Congress. So there was a hearing, I think, in January, where three of the people who are negotiating these documents for the U.S. at the WHO were present. And they were the three witnesses. And they just lied. They blatantly lied. You know, they said, oh, no, none of this has to do about turning over sovereignty. We would never do that. That's against the Constitution, blah, blah, blah. And yet, the WHO is telling nations, you're going to have to pass laws in order to carry out our orders. You have to pass laws to create EUAs if you don't already have them. You have to pass laws to get rid of liability for these EUA products, right? You have to manage liability. You have to, yeah. And so it's very clear. I mean, they written it in the treaty and in the amendments, so you can read it for yourself. But they won't admit it when asked. And so, you know, unfortunately, the mainstream media covers what Tedros says and covers what these other lying U.S. officials say, but they don't cover what's actually in the documents. None of the reporters have read them. I feel like there's just a handful of people in the country that have read the documents. And, you know, we're trying to, and so the treaty is different. So the amendments is completely secret. We haven't seen an updated version of the amendments since November of 2022.
Do you suspect that what they're going to do with that, why it's so secret, is they're on the day or the day before the vote, they're going to go, here it is. Just sort of like when in our Congress, when they put like a 900-page bill, and then like 3 days later, they're supposed to have read it and be able to unwind the doublespeak that's in a lot of those bills. Do you think that the secrecy is because they're, when it comes time for a vote, they're just going to go, here, sign it?
Yes.
Wow.
I do. The treaty is completely different. For the treaty, they've had 7 different versions.
Oh, wow.
They keep coming up with new drafts. So as soon as you've read the next draft and you've figured it out and you understand what's different between that draft and the other drafts. And then they come out with a new draft. So every couple of months, and they change the name on all of them. Each one had a different name except for the last two, which have both been called the pandemic agreement. So I think they finally came up with a name. And I think that was deliberate. So most people couldn't really figure out what was what. But the pandemic agreement sounds very benign. It doesn't sound like a treaty. It doesn't sound like, you know, we all agree, everyone's happy.
So what do you think? And because we're going to get short on time here, we could talk about this for sure for several hours. But what do you think the What do you think the likelihood is of this passing? And if it does pass, what does that really mean for us?
Well, remember, this is a UN agency. So the United States knows generally when it goes into one of these. This, although the United States started this process, it was really the globalists and the multi-billionaires that were pushing it. This is it's not only a giveaway to pharma, but it's moving a tremendous amount of control of health and control of information into the WHO director general, you know, and someone who wasn't really voted on. There was an opaque process by which he got selected. And he's there for 10 years. He's been there for 6 years. He's declared 3 public health emergencies of international concern already. And there are no standards for declaring one. And once he declares one, he gets a lot more power. And so if the documents go through and they look like the drafts that we've already seen, that means he will be able to control information about health. He can tell nations, all nations will be required to perform surveillance of their citizens' social media presence, and he will be able to enforce censorship of any narratives that go against the WHO health narrative. So it's a First Amendment violation. These things violate 5 or 6 different amendments to the Constitution.
So what do you think the likelihood of a passing is? And I know that you set up an entire organization to fight against it. We're going to give you time to talk about it here for a minute. But in lieu of that, in lieu of people understanding and getting involved in your organization, do you think it has a 50-50% chance of passing, you know, 60-40? You know, you're in it. You're swimming in it. What do you kind of feel about
it? So it all depends on how much bribing, how much threatening is done, you know, maybe blackmail is done to the nations and to the diplomat. In some cases, the diplomats are acting and the country doesn't even know what they're doing. The country is, you know, poor countries. Well, you know, the diplomat at the WHO is not an important position. So they don't know what's going on. So votes can be controlled and therefore I don't know. But if everybody learns what's in these documents, nobody will want them because it's basically giving the WHO the power to impose lockdowns more strict than what we had before on the whole world, you know, and vaccine passports, you know, digital IDs, the whole nine yards, shutting down businesses. Nobody wants to go through that again. We'd rather take our chances, you know, and nobody wants an unlicensed vaccine with no liability to be forced on them. So once people find out what's in this, they have the ability to start hounding their elected officials and say, wait a minute, I don't want this. And if we can get enough people knowing what's going on and embarrassing the WHO and the US government, you know, and other governments about what they're willing to subject their citizens to, again, on the basis of no standards, you know, an arbitrary World Health Organization director general just saying so. I mean, he declared monkeypox a global pandemic. You know, he doesn't care. He's not a doctor even. He isn't capable of making the decisions, and the WHO doesn't even have enough medical expertise to be able to make these choices.
So not only, Merle, not only have you taken it on to dig through these literally, because I tried to read them and I couldn't do it. You know, they're boring, they're double speak, they're all kinds of things. You've set up an entire organization to fight back. So tell my audience about that organization, what it is, how they can support it, and what they can do to get in the fight.
Thank you. So you talked in the beginning about how God puts you in a certain place and moves you around the chessboard. And I feel like, you know, when I worked on the anthrax vaccine, I had to deal with legal cases. And so I was forced to read legal documents, even though I hated it. And we brought, you know, we actually brought a legal case and got the license removed from the anthrax vaccine for about 18 months, way back in 2004. So I had the ability from that experience to read legal documents. Not that I like it. And because I knew about biological warfare, I knew about pandemic pathogens, I could read between the lines in these documents. And again, I felt like I had the background to do it and very few other people did. And so I had an obligation to do it. So I did it. And
bless your heart.
You know, it was really bad what I found. And so I was encouraged to start an organization because there were a lot of other organizations. There were a lot of people like you who are very sympathetic, but you're doing other things too. And this seemed to be so egregious, so terrible. It would really transfer tremendous authority to the WHO. And it's a step toward one world government. That's really what it is. It's an easy step. It's a soft coup. So I formed an organization last summer called Door to Freedom. And we have created a large, with a group of about 15 or 20 core members, we've created lots of written materials to explain it. We've collected all the drafts of the pandemic treaty. We've collected all the different versions since 1969 of the international health regulations. So anyone who wants to go through them, it's very easy to find. It's hard to find them on the WHO website. We have them all together. You can read as you will. We also collected the National Defense Authorization Act, which in December of 2022 slipped in a law, a 19-page Pandemic Preparedness Act that says basically we're going to obey the WHO on this.
Wow.
It's quite something. So, and I have been traveling around the world, as have some other people, and giving talks, writing, doing interviews, and trying to get the word out. And now we're creating handouts. We have a timeline. It's the last week of May when these things will be voted on, or maybe they won't be voted on because the WHO tries to avoid voting. Nobody wants their name attached to these, you know, treaties, because they're terrible. They're basically treasonous. They're taking away autonomy and freedom from your citizens and handing over authority to manage our lives to the WHO. And
so where can we find your organization? Darted around that a little bit. I want you to go ahead, promote it.
Thank you. So the organization is called Door to Freedom, and our website is doortofreedom.org. I also work with the Sovereignty Coalition, sovereigntycoalition.org. And we both have action alerts, lots of information about this, videos, articles that anyone from age 12 on up is able to understand. We've got simple articles. We call them 2-minute reads, just the facts, very one or two pages. And then we have articles and links even to academic studies, you know, magazine articles, all sorts of things, so that people at any level can still learn what they need to learn about this. And yes, we are a 501c3. We would love donations. My Substack has paid for a lot of this. We have a staff of several people now. As we approach the time when this vote is going to take place, it'll be in 7 weeks. And so we're rushing very fast to try to get as many people aware as possible, as many organizations. And I really appreciate you having me on for that purpose. So you can download flyers, you can download posters, memes, all sorts of things. And you can ask us questions. And we would love for all your organizations to get involved. We're also doing something. So we're lucky in the United States. We have a constitution that says, if a particular authority or responsibility was not handed over to the federal government at the time we formed a union, then that authority rests with the states or the people. And healthcare, the regulation of healthcare, actually is one of those things that was not handed to the federal government. And so we're suggesting that the states should assert their authority over health and identify the fact that they're not going to turn it over to the federal government or the WHO, but that the regulation of healthcare during and outside of pandemics will remain within the states. This can be done by your legislature passing a resolution. Resolution's not a bill. It's really easy to pass. Doesn't cost any money. It just says, we're not going to go along with the WHO on this.
There are several states that have done that, aren't there?
There are resolutions pending in some states, in about 10 states, but we don't have any that have passed yet.
10 states, that's encouraging. Yes.
It is encouraging. People are realizing that this issue of sovereignty over health is terribly important and can't be left to federal and international authorities. We also would encourage attorneys general to say the same thing. We are the top legal officer of our state, and according to the Constitution, the responsibility for healthcare remains here, not anywhere else. And governors, we would encourage also to make a statement like this. And that will give us publicity, that will help us spread the word. And hopefully the states will start to work like dominoes and we can move this along in the United. And if the United States has a lot of states that say no, that will give strength to these smaller countries around the world to do the same thing. So I hope you will get involved with that. And tell us what state you're, if you know legislators, if you know the attorney general or the governor, get a hold of us, let us know, and let's figure out how we can work together.
And I will also put a plug in for Merle's Substack, which is really quite busy. I can't keep up with all the different things. She kind of uses it like Twitter. She just throws everything out there on it. And but if you want to just keep up to date on everything that's happening with this treaty and these amendments and everything like that, I'm sure that after this is, gone, because I started reading your Substack before you got really involved with all of this and had an enormous amount of really good information, even though now it's pretty focused on the WHO. Tell people what your Substack is so that they can come out and subscribe and either become a free member, but, even better to become a paid member. Where can they find your Substack, Merle?
Thank you. So it's merylnass.substack.com. And I used to have a lot of articles about vaccines and hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin. I wrote a lot of them. I did a lot of that research too early in the pandemic. But now I see this as the biggest threat to all of us, and it's impending. And that's why I have shifted my focus and am trying to provide materials that everyone else can use. Once we get through this and have, so what happens if these documents are accepted at the WHO? Well, nations can still leave the WHO, even though they didn't give us a means to leave the WHO. There's a Vienna Treaty of Treaties that says, look, if a country is in a treaty and they don't think it's going the way they thought it was supposed to, they can leave. They can give notice. And so we can still do that. We can stop paying our dues. And believe it or not, the House of Representatives passed a bill in September that defunded the WHO for this year. That bill is going through the Senate. The two houses are getting together. Leaders are trying to formulate the final version of that bill. It will be voted on Friday.
Oh,
March
wow.
22nd.
This Friday. So, that's amazing.
This Friday. So we want the two provisions to be retained in that bill. It's called the State Department and Foreign Operations Funding Bill. We want that the WHO continue to be defunded, and we want the Senate to be required to provide its advice and consent on the pandemic treaty, because right now the Biden administration is planning not to run these treaties through the Senate. And apparently it turns out they don't have to, that the federal government signs, just as the State Department sign off on treaties, and the Senate never sees most of them. And that's what they would like to do with these two. So at least one of them we want to run through the Senate, because then there will be some questions. Anyway, that's in the bill as well. So we want to keep those two provisions.
And well, Merle, it's been
your local, your state. In Florida, many, at least 10 counties have passed resolutions or ordinances that include no more vaccine mandates and no following the WHO. So at the county level in Florida, these resolutions are going through, and we're supporting that as well.
Well, keep doing what you're doing, my friend. It's just amazing that you've just taken this on and are such a banner of truth and forerunner in the front forefront. Thank you so much for being here with us today to give us an update. We will put the websites and your Substack in the show notes so that people can go and get download the documents. So just today on Merle's Substack today, she was putting out, you know, this is what the flyer is going to look like. What do you guys think? And so it's a very interactive process of, you know, trying to get it to where we can download things and be able to give it to people that they will understand and not just look at it and go, what is this all about? And then we have to go backwards in time and try to explain it. So we're going to try to get a simple first round and then maybe a second round and then maybe a third round sort of documented what people have. So Merle, again, thank you so much for being here with us today. I know that you're traveling and it's really, really busy for you right now. And so we sort of squeezed this in. And so thank you for being able to do that. So I want to thank everybody else for coming here this morning and thank you for being part of this today. You know, it is Monday. So that means tonight on Monday night, 7 p.m. on the Tenpenny Files on Your Health on BrideAnn.tv. We always have great guests and then those are reposted on my Substack, which is drtenpenny.substack.com on Thursday. Tomorrow morning, Tuesday morning at 9 a.m. live with me. It's a morning coffee with Dr. T. Open forum question and answer. We'll just take your questions and answers. And Tuesday night is happy hour with Dr. T. It's our online Bible study. Thursday night is also an online Bible study I hope that you attend and you will enjoy. We're down to the last week here now where you can register for the 5 Docs Boot Camp. The 5 Docs Boot Camp, we did it last year. It was super, super, super attended and people really raved about it and thought it was great. This year's going to be even better. So if you go to learningforyou.org/5, 5 Docs 2024 and get registered. Time is running out, and I think you'll really will enjoy it. It will be on Thursday nights after Critically Thinking with Dr. T and Dr. P from about 8:30 to about 9:45. It will be recorded, and you'll have lifetime access if you have registered for the event. So with that, I want to thank everybody again for being here this morning. I always close out with one of my favorite verses from the Bible, whether it's a live or pre-recorded event, which is Romans 12:12. Rejoice in hope, be patient in trouble, and be persistent in prayer. Until the next time, till we see you next week, same place, same time. Thank you again, Merle, for being here this morning. And have a great week, everybody. Goodbye, and God bless.
In a time when truth is censored, one name stands out. Dr. Sherry Tenpenny, the relentless seeker of knowledge and defender of freedom. Explore groundbreaking findings at drtenpenny.com. Ignite your mind with riveting podcasts, explosive articles, research-driven substacks, webinars, ebooks, and more. In an era plagued by environmental toxins and vaccine-related exposures, Dr. Tenpenny has expertly crafted a selection of safe detox protocols that facilitate profound healing at a cellular level. It's time to cleanse, rejuvenate, and restore your body's vitality. With heart damage on the rise, Dr. Tenpenny introduces nationwide ECP therapy to repair hearts and achieve optimal health. Seize the opportunity and embrace the wealth of resources, information, and health recommendations awaiting you at drtenpenny.com and become a Tenpenny podcast member to join our mission in the quest for uncensored truth, the health of our nation, and medical freedom.